Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And new footage being released of the killing of Tamir Rice by police and the little reported bombing that took place in Denver, Colorado, of the NAACP headquarters is going to be the focus of our attention today, and interesting other pieces that came out around those two incidents. We are joined by Stephen A. Crockett, Jr., Associate Editor of News at the Root, and Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and Africana and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, and author of Notes from a Color Girl, the Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, and forthcoming Letters to My Black Sons Raising Boys in Post-Racial America. And Kay Whitehead and Stephen Crockett, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be
back. Thank you for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Log on to our Facebook pages. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, but please call in 410-319-8888. We'll take your calls in this conversation. Stephen Crockett, let me start with you, and welcome to the program. It's interesting to me how little play the terrorist bombing that took place in Denver has received in the news and the significance of that. Let me just start there with you.
You know, one of the things that our managing editor sort of instills in us is that we're not going to spend any time as an organization trying to figure out why other news organizations aren't following this story. We're just going to cover it, and we're going to give it all our resources and try to push the news that mainstream media is not covering to the forefront. And so one of the things I think the issue here is that, thank God, the gas can that was connected to this thing didn't detonate. Had it detonated, I think you'd be looking at a severe number of casualties. I think you'd be looking at what would be considered a terrorist act, a hate crime, and that sort of thing. But because the gas can didn't detonate, I think now what you have is sort of a lot of speculation, and that's unfair. Because there's two sides to this position, and I think there's those of us who feel this is absolutely a hate crime targeted against us, and there are others that feel, you know, oh, this is just an incident, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. You guys are making more out of this than it needs to be. And I think that's problematic, and I think that's what sort of splits us along this racial divide in this country as it relates to all news stories.
And what do we know for a fact at this moment about what happened in Denver?
Well, we do know that there was some sort of homemade device set outside of the wall of the NAACP office out in Colorado. We know that the device was connected to a gas can that would have caused much more damage. The gas can didn't detonate. We know that the FBI are investigating this and that the NAACP have been hesitant to speculate as to whether or not this was, in fact, a hate crime.
Kay Whitehead, what's your view on this? I think that this, again, shows this divide. I think Tamir Rice, in some ways, we're going to get to in a minute, that really shows even deepening divide in America. But talk about your perspective on this.
I agree with what the first guest said, that we have to make a decision, those of us who are not necessarily in the media, but those of us who want to be conscious and want to be connected to what's happening around the world, we have to decide the stories that we're going to give attention to, the stories we're going to talk about in our classroom. And I did take this story into my classroom, and I was not surprised yesterday that many of my students had not heard anything about it. Because it hasn't really been covered. We've been talking about what's been happening in France. I think this idea, because it wasn't connected to the gas can and we didn't have that type of damage and the lives lost, that people are just saying it's just an incident. We'll just investigate it rather than really focusing on what it really was, which was a hate crime. When you take a look at the sketch, when you think about the NAACP and the work that they do, when you think about the culture that we're in now, then you have to get very serious about who is going to be responsible for telling our stories and making the world take notice of them.
Well, one of the things that always strikes me about stories like this and situations like this is that these kind of overt terrorist actions, as foiled as it is and fumble as this one was, are indicative in many ways of something much deeper. that it represents. Not saying that everybody in America, that America is full of terrorists who want to kill black folks in America. That's absurd. I'm not going there. But what I'm saying is that this is emblematic of something much deeper that we can deal with if we have the wherewithal to do it, Stephen Crockett.
You know, this is, and I know that we were going to talk about Tamir Rice shortly, but I think that's a perfect segue sort of into what does the psychology of a white cop that makes him see sort of a young black man who's carrying a 12-year-old boy who's carrying a toy gun as a threat? What is the psychology behind the person who sees Eric Garner as someone who needs to be choked and taken down, or Michael Brown as someone who needs to be or seen as a demon, I think was a quote. Like there's a real racial psychology that's at play that young black men are dying because of, and that's I think the sort of bigger issue. Here's a sister. So the full video is released of Tamir Rice's shooting. And here's a sister who's running to the aid of her brother who's tackled and put into a police car. Like, what is the psychology behind that? That's the deepening sort of sad racial history that's at play when these situations take place. You don't see a child. You see a thug or a threat or someone that has to be shot and taken down. And what's that about? Because that's the problem. And that's the problem that I think that's really not being addressed.
And there's also the fact that's come out now because of this video that the police, when they shot Tamir Rice, pulled up on him in this playground, and within 1.5 to 2 seconds of barely getting out of the car, shot him dead. Well, shot him in the stomach, and he died suffering on the ground.
I just want to add that this idea of thinking about the mindset, which I think tends to permeate through all the conversations we're having around this notion of Black Lives Matter and focusing, of course, on black boys. I think about that in the context of what happened with Julia Shills. I don't know if people follow that story in Chattanooga, Tennessee, but here's a 45-year-old white woman shooting a gun out the window, shooting at people. She pointed the gun at the police, and they were able to capture her without incident. That the idea was not to shoot someone who's shooting out, and here's a 12-year-old boy who is waving a toy gun who did not fire any shots, and you're making that decision in 1.2 seconds or so to take his life. And I think when you watch the video, and it is painful to watch, because his sister is fighting, she's getting up, you see her wanting to get to his body. And when you have these police officers finally just grab her up and throw her in the back of the police car, it's not just the fact that her brother is on the ground dying. It's also no respect for the family and to give her a chance, even if they took her over, to be with him while he's bleeding to death because he did not die until the next day. So the disdain that was shown by the cops as he's laying on the ground dying and not even offering him any aid or assistance further adds to this notion about where we are seen and where our black boys are seen by this society, by those who are supposed to hold power and have authority in this country, and they're making these split-second decisions to take the lives of our black boys.
So, you know, one of the things I really would like to spend some time over the next months and period of time to figure out how you get underneath of and change in the society. It is just this, what came out of this study, I don't know if any of you followed the study that came out of the American Psychological Association that was published in March, but the researchers at the University of California in Los Angeles, and this was published in the APA's Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, they tested 176 police officers, mostly white males, the average age was 37, almost all of them coming from large urban areas. And so they to test for bias,
right,
and for prejudice and unconscious dehumanization of black people by comparing them to apes in a different series of tests, and the test showed it was that the officers who were more likely to dehumanize black people in general and black men in particular, that their use of force, takedown, wrist locks, kicking, punching, striking with blunt objects, using police dogs, restraints and hobbling and tear gas and killing, were more likely to use those things than others. And this is they had a companion study of 264 mostly white women who were undergraduate students at large universities, and the kind of same perceptions and the perceptions of young black boys who were 10 or to 17 being seen as being men from 20 to 35 years old. And so, I mean, so there's something very deep here in our psyche in America. The question is, we can't do this today, but I'm very interested in how you get under that to move that, to change that.
I think that one of the pieces of it, and I know this is part of our conversation, is the ways in which Black men are profiled and the ways in which Black men are seen and talked about in the media. This fear factor that gets instilled into not just white America, but of course in certain parts of Black America as well, with young boys from an early age being seen as a threat, being seen as aggressive, being seen as someone who's looking to do something to you. So you begin to act out of this fear, and it is this fear that leads you to make these type of decisions. I mean, that's one of the things we talked about with Ferguson in Baltimore. How can we get people to be in charge of policing their own community? How can we get the police officers to spend more time in these communities to get to know the residents as people, not just as people you have to cage as animals, but they are individuals who are invested in seeing their communities to thrive. So we have these studies that are coming out. That one, I think, at the Harvard implicit test that just recently came out, asking the question, are you racist, and then answering with probably yes, that we're only using this data to back up what we're seeing in society and what we have seen in society for years. And it's not something that's new. We're talking about it in so many ways like it's new. But you know, Mark, from your work with the civil rights movement, this is an old issue we're dealing with how Black men are profiled and seen as something to fear and seen as a threat.
I think it's true. And I think Stephen Crocker, though, I keep saying this over and over again on the air here, is that we're at a junction in American history where the struggle today is a different struggle than it was 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle, I think, in some ways, to change hearts and minds to deal with the question of why there is such deep systemic racism and how to overcome it in this country.
Which I think is a much more difficult struggle in so many ways.
Right.
You know, you start talking about
because
having,
it's so much subtle.
It's more subtle. It gets to your social value system.
Stephen?
You know, the other part to this, so I think there's the first part, which is changing the sort of culture and policing and having police in the community to get to see the people that they are policing as actual people. It's sort of the first part. I think the back end is that there has to be a change in the judicial system that has these officers held accountable for their behavior. I think what we have now is an officer who can say, I thought that person had a gun, I was in fear for my life, and then there's impunity from that point on. Mm-hmm. Like, at that point, the story stops. As long as you were worried about getting home to your family, it didn't matter if you took someone else from there. And that's an issue. And
right.
I think on both ends, Black lives have to matter. They have to matter on the front end, but also if they're lost, then there has to be someone held accountable for that law.
Mm-hmm. Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Russ, you're on the air. Welcome.
Greetings, Mark, to you and your guests.
Good morning.
Please enjoy the health of New Year so far.
You too.
Mark, you know, we've had many conversations like this, and each time what we try to do is a sane, rational, objective way, deal with an issue that is totally irrational, wholly subjective, and I think personally deeply rooted in insanity. When you look at these issues, you see a dichotomy. We just had an incident here in Baltimore where guys allegedly shot at the police over on Gwynne's Falls Parkway, and he was to do with a taser. He was not shot, surprisingly enough, by Baltimore City Police. So there are alternatives if we look for them. But, you know, when Tardy says that a Black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect, what he was saying is that we have no rights but those which flow for white folks. And so it's from a psychological point of view, you know, you get into a different bag because you've got folks that will go back and talk to you about the curse of Ham in terms of what gave the white man superiority over the Black man. So how do you get at that issue? I mean, you can objectively make people respect you. We had many changes in the law on an objective point of view. But subjectively, how do you get someone to accept you and see you as they see themselves? Leave it at that. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much, Russ. Before we go to break here, Kay, why don't you pick up on that first?
Oh, I thought what he said was right on point, and it gets to the heart of what we're talking about. How do we change the way in which we see one another? How do we change the way in which we're able to accept and respect one another? How do you get to the social value system that lays at the heart of who we are in this country? And this is why it's so subtle, and this is also why it's so difficult. I think what happens to change the game, which I think is very, very interesting is that unlike before, we have all these videos being released. So it's no longer just saying, oh, I thought I was in fear of my life. We can now go to the video, and you can make decisions based upon what you see, not what you're told. And this is why people were concerned with Eric Garner. We saw the video. So how can you watch that video and not say that that police officer was at fault and those that were around him were at fault as well? How can you watch the video of Tamir Rice and not be appalled and be concerned?
So one of the pieces here, we're about to go to break here, but we'll come right back. I'm going to pick up the phones and go right to Leo, our next caller up, and to bring Stephen Crockett right back into the conversation. And on our way to break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding and testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. And on our way to break, we're hearing Love TKO by the wonderful Teddy Pendergrass, who passed away on this day in 2010. We'll be right back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's People of the Sun by Rage Against the Machine. Zach DeLaRocca of Rage Against the Machine, born on this day in 1970. We are joined by Stephen Crockett, Associate Editor of the News at The Root, and Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of Africana and African American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, author of Notes from a Color Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, and you at 410-319-8888. As I said, we'll go right to the phones and come right back to Stephen Crockett for the response. Leo in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows. How are you?
And a happy new year to you and your guests.
Happy new year to you.
I'm of the opinion, and you correct me if I'm in error, that in the case of Tamir Rice and many others, most of these police officers, the vast majority, 90% police and fire departments, they don't live in the cities that they are patrolling, but they are charged with protecting and serving. And so we hear this continuous mantra of the police need sensitivity training, and somehow the sensitivity training will eliminate their biases and their prejudicial conduct. And I would submit, along with sensitivity training, you've got to send officers who are offending parties, who commit murder, you've got to send them to jail. And if we're not going to have a track record that succeeds in sending these folks to jail, then we're just spinning our wheels. We're on a treadmill to nowhere. As I said, the vast majority of these police officers don't live in the municipalities. There are no residency requirements in Baltimore City or any other that I know of that says police have to be here, have to live in this jurisdiction.
Right.
And that's a terrible mistake. And the mayor of Baltimore City has said, essentially, as of 2 years ago, we brought this question up, she said she didn't care where they live. Well, I disagree. I care. And if they're not in within the jurisdiction within a year, you give them a time frame to move in the city.
All right.
That's a starting point. But they're carpetbaggers.
Leo, I appreciate your call. And Stephen Crockett, what's your thought on that?
You know, this is the issue that came out of Ferguson. So 97% of the police who were policing Ferguson did not live in Ferguson. They were 97% white. I think out of 150 officers, 147 of them were white. And so this is an issue that has occurred. This is an issue that continues to sort of be perpetuated, which is you are policing a community that you know nothing about. or that the assumption is you know nothing about. You come into this community from another community, and you are policing that community, and in turn, you are probably perceiving a lot of situations wrong. And this is one of the issues that Ferguson had, and this is a tension that had been growing prior to the Michael Brown shoot, which is these police come in and they treat us when they talk to people. When CNN got there and the Washington Post got there, they were talking to people on the ground, and they were having trouble finding someone who hadn't been harassed by the police, who hadn't been accosted by the police, who hadn't had an encounter with the police that was of question. I think sort of that's the first part. And the other part is, you know, there is an issue that says, look, you have to move into that community and have to get a feel for that community, which would help you see that community as people. And I think as long as you don't live around that community and consider yourself to be policing a community and only policing a community, then the people who live there automatically become criminals, whether they've done something criminal or not.
Okay, on the other end of that is that there are a lot of studies also show that police, black, white, Latino, Asian, whoever they are, often react in the same way. And then you have, of course, the opposite anecdotal evidence that we did at a town meeting, national town meeting we had here a few weeks back, where it was the black police officers in the audience who were part of the conversation who were saying there has to be something deeper happening, like a police civilian review board with teeth. I mean, there's a lot of it's a complex issue.
Complex. I think that sometimes people forget that part of what police officers are doing is not just protecting, they're also supposed to be serving. Like, they're not just there to keep people in cages and keep them back and keep things under control. They're supposed to be interacting in a very comfortable way with these communities. I don't know if it's so much as having them move into the communities, because I have come in contact with students, Caucasian students, who've never really even been around black people, who have no idea of the interacting, not just of the community, but as a whole, which is still a big surprise to me. So do you need to live in the community? Do you need sensitivity training? Do you need to spend more time learning how to see people differently? Is it talking about your social value system? I think it's a very complex issue. Just getting a house in the community may not be enough, but there has to be ways where police officers and communities can begin to work together. I don't know if that means spending more time, not just in your police car driving around, but in the community centers, in the after-school programs, going into the churches. Like, there has to be ways where you can be a part of the community without having to live there.
And I kind of taking that another step further, when you think about what was just posited, I mean, I think that there's two levels here. One has to do with many people arguing for much stronger civil organizations, Stephen Crockett, like a civilian review board that has the power, as they do in Toronto, Canada, to hire and fire not just the police chief, but also the police officers, as well as exonerating the police officers. They have actual investigative powers to make things happen that we do not. And I think that's one kind of legislative legal remedy, governmental remedy, that might go a long way to dealing with this issue.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that's being missed here is that you are sort of here to protect and serve in the community that you're a part of, or that you're policing. And the other part to that is, if you are dishonoring that community, then doesn't the community have a right to say that you no longer need to be a part of this? And that's something that I think is a very interesting take that needs to be addressed. One of the things that they're looking at now is, how does protest in Ferguson and New York and around the country now turn into policy change?
Right.
And that's something that they're looking at now, is sort of, how do we effectively change this process? How do we look at this and say, no more of these sham grand jury hearings? No more of these trials before an actual trial.
Right.
No more acquittals in situations where no one's even been brought to justice. No one's actually been put in front of a jury and had an opportunity to be questioned. You know, there has to be a process where this turns from rage, which I actually agreed with in the beginning, into, because that's a cathartic process, right? That you get an opportunity to be fully enraged in relation to a death. And then you get to move into some more sort of thinking parts of the process that affect policy change. But how does that look? And sort of what would that be? And I think that's an effective idea or proposal to be considered at this stage.
Let me jump back to the phones here and come right back to our guest, 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air.
How you doing again, Mr. Stein?
It's been a long time, Hank. Good to hear from you.
I am blessed, young man, right? I think we're looking at it from a different perspective, right? first of all, love ourselves and know ourselves, right? See, if you love yourself enough to get enough education to where you can compete, and not necessarily compete with anybody, but compete with thinking minds around the world. It ain't black or white. See, we don't see each other as people. We see each other as race. And I say this quite often to you all the time, Mark. We are animals first and humans second, no matter what the race is. We all have that same animalistic response. Protect and defend ourselves and our brood. And we are all human race. We are not black, white, or whatever. We have different hues, but we are human, right? So when we learn to deal with that in a respectful way and learn to love ourselves, then we will be able to deal with the problems that we have. Nobody's dealing with these issues.
Hank, always good to hear from you and your thoughts on this. And I think that's wrestling with that huge subject is something that we can do. I mean, the whole question of how we treat one another as human beings, and this kind of notion of race that's been put upon us in this world over the last 500 years, that has changed the nature of our human thinking, is part of the problem. Did we have time for one more quick call here before we get final thoughts? 410-319-8888. Sean, you're on the air.
How you doing, Mark? Thanks for taking my call.
Good morning, Sean.
I think sometimes we create difficult solutions for things that can be simple. And I think in this case, if you look at what's going on with the police, we would love for there to be harmony and a greater interaction, diversity training, and all those sorts of things. But I think most people would be okay if we at least start off with people being held accountable for killing other people. So I work in human resources, for example, and we always know that sometimes you have bad hires. And when you have bad hires, you got to hold people accountable. So to me, it's a simple thing of dealing with the unions. It's no different than the same conversations we've been having about teachers. Everybody doesn't think most teachers are bad, but we know that there are some bad ones, just like there are some bad police officers, and those people need to be held accountable, but they're protected by these unions. So until they're held accountable for the things that they're doing, it doesn't matter what amount of training you have. It doesn't matter where people live. When bad cops do bad things, they have to be held accountable.
I think that that's a very important point, I'm going to turn to our guests both here, Stephen Crockett and then Kay Whitehead, very quickly to give your closing thoughts on this and where you think we go from here as we continue to probe this situation. Stephen?
You know, I think protests are powerful, but I think policy change is even better. I think trying to look at ways to change policy, I think holding officers accountable, I think working towards sensitivity training or moving them into the neighborhood, whatever, there needs to be a change in this process that stops letting officers kill unarmed black people with impunity. There has to be a change.
Kay Whitehead.
And I just want to add to that as we begin to focus on policy change, I think another layer of that is to be involved with teach-ins, to look at the ways that we can train people differently. The issue is not just with the police officers, though that's what we're focusing on now. There's the issue around the microaggressions and the ways in which black people are treated in other sectors as well. I don't think it's just that we see each other as race, because if you look at the number of people who involve across races and ethnicities with the Black Lives Matter movement that's going across the world, we know that this is a bigger concern than just a black and white issue. It's about lives mattering and finding a way to help people to see that and to see beyond these issues.
And I appreciate that both of you joining us here, and I think that this is something we're obviously continuing to probe, and I think that the movement in this city where we broadcast from and across the country to look for a stronger civilian police review board process at the very least, while we also address the issue of the underlying cause of this in the consciousness of America that has to change over the next generations to come, that we have to fight for in the 21st century to deal with the question of rooting out the ugliness of racism in our society is something we'll continue to talk about. I want to thank Dr. Kay Whitehead from Loyola University, who wrote the book Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, and Stephen A. Crockett, Jr., Associate Editor of News at the Root. For both of you, thank you for taking your time with us today.
Thank you so much, Mark. Anytime.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back from this break, we're going to break with Someday We'll All Be Free by the great Donna Hathaway, who passed away on this day in 1979. We're going to look at the slaughter of human beings by the Boko Haram in Nigeria. Stay with us. We'll be right back. To the world as it's been.